Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Boothcast. Tomorrow night, the 3rd of June at 7:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time, I'll be going live with Shore & Partners CEO Earl Evans and Director of Ocean Paddler, Dean Gardner. Tomorrow night, we'll be talking all things Australian Ocean Racing Series and launching all the dates, the events, the prize money, and everything that's going to be happening this summer for ocean paddling. So if you want to tune in, please do so. All the live links are up on Ocean Paddler, Shore & Partners, and my own page on Facebook. And you can actually, it's actually an interactive live Q&A. So you can jump on there and ask any questions that you have about the series, about the events, or about anything happening with ocean paddling. So we'll be all there to answer your questions. So 7:30 tomorrow night, there'll be a whole host of good stuff and special events that we'll be launching. So now I'm going to throw you over to my interview with Te Puri King. Hello and welcome to Boothcast. On Boothcast, I speak to people who inspire me about sport, business, and the winning mindset. Today's guest is from New Zealand. His name is Te Puri King. He is a Waka Ama paddler and he's got had a very successful career so far. He's a 5-time New Zealand champion. He's raced in the Super Eito. He's raced in the Hawaii Kanui. He's raced in Molokai Ho with some of the top teams. So for me, it's going to be a really interesting lesson to learn a little bit more about this world and to hear just how it all works and what goes into it to become a top paddler in this different water sport. So Te Puri, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting conversation for me. As we're speaking about just before we came on, I don't know too much about this world, so it's going to be a little bit of an insight and a bit of an understanding for me. So can you give the listeners a little bit of a snapshot into the who you are and what you do and where you're from?
Yeah, for sure. Kia ora, guys. My name is Te Puri King. I'm all the way from Aotearoa, New Zealand, born in Hamilton, raised in the far north. And I pretty much grew up paddling, doing waka ama or outrigger canoeing, as most people know it as. Started around the age of 7, 26 years old now, so almost 20 years in the sport. It wasn't, however, until I started going to university at Waikato in 2012, where I started to get a bit more competitive and started competing overseas in 2013. And for the past 7 years, it's been this massive journey, traveling all around the world, Tahiti, Hawaii mainly, for these big canoe races, both individually and in six-man. Had the privilege of paddling with some top teams, Paddling Connection, Kala Huikai, and yeah, it's been an awesome journey. I think my biggest national achievements would probably be in our sprint events. So like you said, 5-time 500 meter and 250 meter sprint champion. And for the long distance, I think maybe 6 to 7-time long distance open men New Zealand champion, second in at the world events. Haven't quite won the world championship, that's still on my goal list, but yeah, I think I'm still young and I've still got a bit of paddling to go, I hope.
Yeah, so you're 26 years old, but you were born into a paddling family from what I've read. So can you give us a little bit of a backstory into your family and how involved they've been in paddling for like generations, I guess?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely born into a paddling family. Well, my father was the first one to start paddling out of our family, and he was introduced to it by my uncle. And I'm actually the only boy of three sisters. I have three sisters, and I'm actually a twin to one of them. And me and my twin sister, we're the youngest. So we kind of grew up with my older two sisters paddling. They were the first to start paddling. My dad coached them. They went on to win world championships in Hawaii. My sister Rose King, she was actually the king, as they call it. She was winning multiple New Zealand champion. She was world sprint champion. She also went to Tahiti to compete in the TI Tour and all of these kinds of things before I even stepped on the scene. My mother, who was introduced to paddling a little bit later on, within 2 years, she was world sprint champion and ended up being multiple world sprint champions. So my dad's a renowned coach and also still competing to this day, 65 years old. So definitely a Wakaama paddling family. And yeah, I think I kind of made this my go at Wakaama a little bit later, as I guess the sisters kind of died out a little bit. Mum and dad still paddling, or all the family is still paddling here and there, but I guess I'm kind of holding up the fort for now. Yeah.
And what was it like growing up, obviously, with your sisters obviously paddling so much and your family and your parents paddling? Why did you not take it seriously straight away like they did? Like you said, you sort of started really paddling hard at maybe 19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess back then when I was young, I think it was more of a seasonal kind of thing for us, especially in New Zealand. The winter time, you know, it gets cold here. So, and I grew up with a lot of other sports, rugby, and I was into a lot of other things. So it was only really 1 or 2 months out of the year where our parents would pull us aside and chuck us in teams and train us for the national sprints. And we'd get really excited, you know, and we'd go and we'd love to compete. But then soon enough, as the winter came along, we kind of just died off. And it wasn't until December the following year that we kind of picked it up again. So I think what really, it was an interesting time as I got older and I left high school and went to university. I still hadn't missed the national sprint championships. I still went every year, like I said, a seasonal thing. However, it wasn't until I went to university and I started studying sport and leisure studies, I started to learn a little bit more about the body and how to train and how it adapts to training. And I started kind of applying those principles to my training. And it wasn't directly to paddling straight away. I just learned how to get fit in the gym, whatever, just and kind of adapt, kind of, I guess I like to refer to it as kind of got addicted to training in a way, because back then I was 103 kilos. Sorry.
You're right.
Hope that didn't cut out. Yeah, that was just a bit of a battery. 103 kilos and managed to get really trim before the national sprint championships. And I thought, I'm going to give it a good go. So I just started training hard. And then that year I wound up winning my first championship. So it was from then that motivation and that, you know, that kind of drove me to where I am now. It just created a domino effect that, you know, year to year, I wanted to get better and better and better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here I am.
And you have the Train Like a King Paddle Academy, I guess you could call it, online. And I know you've focused really hard on that. You do your sports and leisure studies, and you've done a master's degree also in, I don't know, physical performance. Why was there such an affinity for you to be able to want to study the human body and be able to apply those principles to Wakaama?
Oh, man. For me, it probably started all the way back in high school. I mean, I was always into, you know, physical education over anything. You know, I was the kid that was out playing touch or rugby on the field at lunchtimes. And I like to say I wasn't the brightest student. I mean, I did, you know, I ticked along and I got things done. But sport and exercise has kind of always been my go-to or practical thing. So, and then Wakaama has been involved in my life, or, you know, all my life. So I've grown up with it. So it worked out. Even looking back at that pinnacle moment and going to university and being so, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, but I kind of just found that new sense of passion for paddling. And a big reason that kind of motivated me, a thing that helped me the most, was actually somebody invited me to Tahiti And for everyone out there that knows Waka'ama, knows that Tahiti is the, they are the pinnacle of the sport of Waka'ama, Va'a, paddling. So I had a great opportunity to go over there and compete in a six-man race around 3 days around Tahiti Nui, covering 166 kilometers. And I was the youngest of the team, and it just blew my mind. I just came back with this sense of energy. I just wanted to go back. And I remember coming back, and my father must have known how excited I was. So he said, "Oh, do you want to go back for the Te'ai Tour?" which is this big individual race. And so I said yes, and I went back and I did that. And then, like I said, it was just a domino effect. 7 years later, I've been competing there 7 years in a row. So it's been pretty awesome.
Yeah, and obviously being able to have that physiology and understanding the body and understanding the technique that little bit better has obviously helped you push to the forefront of Waka'ama. When you were a kid, and you're playing these different sports, and you were doing, like, obviously probably playing rugby because you're from New Zealand. So that's probably what every young kid aspires to be like. Yeah. What was it like, obviously, playing in rugby union, but then in your summer period, then going into Waka? What was the cultural aspect of the change? Because I know that, obviously, union's probably the main sport in New Zealand. Every young kid wants to grow up and be, I'm not sure what the names in the New Zealand rugby team, but like the best rugby player they can be. And then you're stepping over to Waka and you're finding that you're quite successful at that. When did you realize, okay, maybe I'm not going to play union like all the rest of the boys. I'm going to start to step into Waka and actually give that more of a crack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting story because, I started playing rugby just like any New Zealand kid, and under sevens. And back then, even my twin sister was playing rugby with me at that time. And I just remember going through all the grades right through high school. And I loved it. I loved playing rugby. It's just such a New Zealand thing to do, I guess. And but there was definitely a turning point for me. In 2000, near my last year of high school, 2011, I believe, I actually suffered not just one, but two really bad shoulder dislocations from rugby. And not at the same time, they were kind of alternate years, but they definitely took, the first one took a lot of physio and recovery just to come right. And then I remember winning our first 15 competition in the far north of New Zealand. And our coach had this idea, since we won our Northland competition, that we would invite Auckland region's first 15 champions to come up and play us. So St. Kentigan's College, who have now these guys who ended up playing for the All Blacks, they came up and it just felt like we were playing men. And I remember I dislocated my other shoulder in that game. And from then, the shoulder dislocation just kept occurring and occurring. So eventually, the physio said, either I take a year off or I have surgery on my shoulder. So I took a year off and went to university the following year. And I have to say, I haven't had a game of rugby since. So it's kind of a blessing in disguise, really. Who knows? I like to think I might have been an All Black if I didn't suffer that injury. We have a Blackburn Seven player in the back here. That
okay. Yeah, very good.
So, just going to plug my phone in, sorry.
Yeah, you need to plug your phone in. It's always a hassle when your phone runs out of battery. But it must be just such a common trend in New Zealand to obviously play union and try and be the best at it. But yeah, if you're getting multiple shoulder dislocations, it's not going to be much fun going forward. So that's when you really kicked into gear for the Waka'ama stuff. Yep. You have a really successful year in like 2013, and then 2014 you have a world championship win. Can you talk us through that? Oh, sorry, a world championship third place.
Yeah. So those early years were quite, I have to say, they were quite, they came by so quickly. because even 2013 was my first New Zealand win, but I was actually not in the open men's division at the time. I was a bit younger than that, but I chose to go up anyway. So I was quite surprised. And then 2014 was my first World Championships competing in the open men division. And that year it was held in Brazil. And that was an awesome experience going over there. And everybody knows that Tahiti is the pinnacle of the sport. So when I went over there, it's a little, the sprint worlds is a little bit different to the long distance worlds format, whereby the sprints, you can take a certain amount of paddlers from your own country to compete. So I remember there being three or four Tahitians that I competed against for a medal. And it was really a big deal for me because I managed to beat a couple of them for the bronze medal. And that was huge. Whereas the long distance worlds, you can only actually take one person. So thankfully I only have to race one Tahitian at the World Long Distance Championships.
Yeah, for sure. And what is it about Tahiti and their paddling culture that makes them at the forefront of like Wakaama or V1 or OC1 or anything basically that they're paddling, they're always at the front? What is it about Tahiti and their paddling environment that makes them the best?
To me, I compare it to New Zealand and rugby. So in Tahiti, paddling is their national sport. They say it used to be soccer, but I think paddling, when you go there, it is obvious that it's just insane. The amount of people that are out there mornings and afternoons paddling in groups is just crazy. And I think they're introduced to it at such a young age. Like, I mean, I started young paddling here, 7 years old. However, like I said, it was always a seasonal thing and it was always sprint focused. You know, so it's easy to send your kid out there and just, you know, okay, hammer this 250 or this 500, you know, 5 to 6 times, and then you're done. Whereas what I see in Tahiti is they're training kids for marathons, similar to marathon running. You know, like these kids that at such a young age are going out and doing an hour or two in the morning, and then they'll come back in the afternoon. You know, they're building that endurance from such a young age. By the time these kids hit junior 16, junior 19, they're competitive with the Opens. And a lot of those champions, you can see that the likes of Kevin, who has been, Kevin Sidon Jerusalemi is the current world long distance champion. And he's also the current sprint champion, which is, it just blows my mind.
Yeah, that is incredible.
Both. At 105 kilos too, he's a big boy. But when you look at his track record, he was competing, he was podium finishers at the age of, say, 15 or 16. Like, at such a young age, he's competitive in the Open Te Aito. And I think that's one of their secrets, is just starting at such a young age, building that you know, that building those mitochondria and those muscles is just, you just can't beat it. And I mean, he reaps, like, the likes of Kevin just reap the rewards now. You can be a little bit heavier than what people probably would recommend and still, you know, be a champion.
Yeah, so they basically start very well. I know Keone Solpice is a young guy in the stand-up world, and he's been paddling since he was so young. Like, I remember racing, I think he was like 13, and he was like keeping up with us. And I was just like, what is going on? What's different over here? These guys are just whipping at such a young age. So it'd be interesting to see how his growth comes through. But you have sort of Kevin and Stevie, who are probably the top two Va'a paddlers in the world for a long time. Would that be correct? And what is it about those two? Is it just like, they've been paddling for such a long period of time, or are they just vicious races as well?
Yeah, those two are definitely two of the top dogs from Tahiti. Stevie is the same. Steve, I remember 2009 or maybe 2008, Stevie Boy won the Te Aito Open as a junior, I believe. And it just goes to show the same thing, like those, and a lot of people don't actually know, because Kevin, in his prime, he paddled for one of the top teams called Shelva'a, and he was in that team as a junior, and they've won basically everything. And Steve Tehotata is another paddler that's really well known, that paddles for Iriti Va'a, and they've won the Hawaiki Nui 4 to 5 times, you know, consecutively. But what a lot of people don't know, if you actually take a look back, is that Steve and Kevin actually used to both paddle for EDT in the same canoe, and as juniors. There were two juniors paddling for this open crew, and they basically won every big race that you could think of. I believe one of the big, especially coming back to Kevin, when you look at his father, Kevin's father was actually a really big champion in Tahiti. He paddled for a team called Team Mobile, which I believe is the earlier team Shelva'a, when Mobile was still around and not bought out by Shell. And when you look at that team from back then that included Kevin's father, there's another guy, Wilfred Armin, who is actually now the coach of Paddler Connection, was in there. So you can see the depth that Ba'a goes, you know, like the technique even back then was just supreme. So I've heard stories of Kevin's father, you know, after school, picking him up from school, and instead of taking him home, he'll drop him, you know, 2 hours away from home and say, "Oh, you can paddle home," and he'll be crying and all that. But, you know, he definitely reaps the rewards now.
Yeah, you sort of have that bit of a hard taskmaster, I guess, and you sort of get those big paddles in when you're a youngster, and you're able to be strong when you get older. I used to love training as a kid, so I know that I'm reaping a lot of rewards from the amount of work that I did from a kid now in the stand-up. So it definitely works out. But what's it like paddling for one of those big Tahitian teams? Like you speak of EDT, Shelva'a, Mobile, Paddling Connection, which is the team that you paddled for. What was it like going over there and competing for that team for 4 years?
It was mind-blowing. It was definitely a dream come true for me. Like I said, my first trip to Tahiti was in 2013, and that was for a team race. And I vividly remember, and I've still got the photo, at night I went up to all the canoes that were just waiting for day two of the race, and I took a photo of Paddling Connection's canoe, and I was just like, my caption might have been like dream team, you know, something like this, just out there, never knowing that 2 years later, I would be paddling for them. And the way that happened was in 2015, I got my first top 10 finish in the Super Idol. And that night, Wilfred Armin, the coach of Paddling Connection, turned up at wherever I was staying and said, do you want to paddle with us? And I was like, I just couldn't say no. So I went home and fundraised, and we went to California for the Catalina. We won that. And then I competed in my first Hawaiki Nui that year. So it was definitely a dream come true. I never would have thought I would be paddling for one of the top teams, especially Paddling Connection, which is a really respected team, because it's not owned by a big corporation like Shell or EDT or OPT. It's really derived from family, and, you know, that it has a really, really strong connection there. So, yeah, it was an amazing experience. The best we did and also coming into the team, 2015 was a big deal for me, because they had previously in 2013, they had won the Hawaiki Nui, which was a crazy, amazing achievement. So it was kind of a lot of, not pressure, but, you know, expectations. And I believe the best we did was second in Hawaiki Nui while I was with them. Yeah.
And can you talk listeners through, who may not really understand the Hawaiki Nui? Like, it's a race from Huahine to Raiatea, and then you do a race in like Raiatea and Ta'a, then you go down to Bora Bora, which is actually the leg that I've done for the Maramu Surf Ski race that Masol runs down there. Can you walk us through what that race is like, and how many people participate, and what the feeling is when you're participating in that race?
Oh man, it is the most epic race of all. It's just definitely so. I hold the Hawaiki Nui beyond any world championship race there is. It's just the pinnacle of va'a. When it comes to racing, so there's two main divisions. There's open and then masters. And then they have one on one day, they have junior and woman. But basically, it's a three-day race, like you said, between Huahine, Raiatea, Taha, and Bora Bora. And every day is different. Every leg is different. So the first day is a 46-kilometer, basically downwind. And that's a really tough leg, because sometimes the surf isn't in your favor. It's kind of coming from your armor side, which can be quite tippy, and you end up with a really sore behind. And then day two is between Raiatea and Taha, is short but flat because it's still in the lagoon. And then the last day is the longest, is around 56 kilometers from Taha to Bora Bora, and that has the most epic downwind section within there. However, you've got to paddle, say, an hour at the beginning inside the pass, then you get out the pass, 2 hour downwind or something like that, and then you're not quite finished. You think you're finished, you see the finish line, but you've still got to come inside the pass and paddle another 40 minutes to get to the finish line. So it's the thing that makes the Hawaiki Nui really tough, however, when you compare it to, say, Molokai Hoi and all of these other races, is that you don't actually change during the race. So Molokai Hoi, for example, is 62 kilometers, but you're allowed to change three paddlers whenever you like. Whereas yeah. Hawaiki Nui, once you've picked your team for the day, that's it. You're doing that whole leg iron. So I think that's what makes it such a brutal race. Yeah,
it's quite interesting coming to the bottom of Bora Bora, and you have like the sort of the channel marker that you go around, and then it just goes flat, like offshore, and then you got to like come through the pass. There's only really one pass at Bora Bora. Come in, and then you go into the town, I assume, like we did with the surf ski race, and it just it's a long paddle.
But it's tough, yeah.
How many times have you done the Hawaiki Nui?
I believe I've done Hawaiki Nui with Paddling Connection 2015, 16, 17, and 18.
Yep.
Four times with Paddling Connection. And then last year, I performed the Hawaiki Nui with my team, Kalahui Kai from Hawaii. I spent majority of the year for the OC1 single season and then the six-man season with them. So, it was definitely a new experience with my Hawaiian team. Good to get a lot of those guys down there. A lot of them, obviously, first time. So, it was really good for them.
And when you're talking about doing this Hawaii Kanui, is it mainly Tahitian teams, or do you have other teams coming in from different places, or how does the whole setup of the race work? Because I know like in Wakaama or OC1 or whatever circles, that is your main race. That's the one that you want to do the best in, because it is so brutal. It is hard, and it's basically steeped in tradition. I think it's been around since 93 or something like that, or 91. So it's got nearly 30 years of tradition now. What is it like, obviously, with those different teams coming in? And is it mainly a Tahitian race, or is it a race where lots of different teams come in?
Yeah, it's definitely a race that's open to internationals, but I believe like it's that prestigious and that difficult, and a lot of people know it's that difficult, that you know, if you are gonna do this race or decide to do this race, you kind of have to really commit. Like you don't want to just decide that we're gonna go do the Hawaiki Nui. I think most foreign teams know that it's physical, it's mental, and it requires a lot of preparation. Even just the logistics of the race, like, you know, finding places to stay on every single island, a support boat that's gonna, you know, follow you around everywhere is quite a big process. So it's definitely a difficult race to do overall, but you do have a lot of international appearances, but the main appearances have been really, really well thought out teams. So I know that Hawaii took a really good team 1 year to the Hawaii Nui, and they just took all of their best OC1 paddlers and just chucked them into this one team, and they did really well. But I still believe it was like a sixth place, you know, something like that. Like, it just goes to show the level of competition in Tahiti. So we're yet to send one, a New Zealand team to the Hawaii Nui. That would be a really cool achievement one day to see a really good team go down and compete in the Hawaii Nui.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like a pretty incredible race. And one day I hope to get out there and do it and just sort of be there and participate and just have a bit of fun and have a challenge for those different islands, because I know it's such an amazing place to paddle. And as you say, there's such a massive fanfare, spectators. Like, it's just a crazy place to paddle. And you sort of feel like you're a bit of a celebrity in a way, because there is just sort of such an involvement of all the Tahitians in all those paddling races. So it's a great vibe. But when you're talking about like these different teams you're talking about, like, do they all basically train on the island as a team every single day? It's like they're paid to be paddlers. Like, can you walk us through that setup of the different athletes and how the teams work?
Yeah, so when I talk about the big teams, like, it's really interesting in Tahiti the way that they work and how they have worked for so long. Is the big corporate teams, like when I say Shell, Va'a, EDT, they're all owned by these big companies. So obviously Shell is the petrol company. EDT is their electricity company, their main electricity company. And then OPT is their post office company, but also I think they do kind of Wi-Fi and stuff like that. So and then I believe there's another, Air Tahiti, which is the airline. They have a team. So they kind of work this way, you know, the big teams. And it's kind of a really good opportunity for Tahitians, because, you know, a lot of them, it's quite hard to find jobs and things like that. So with these big teams, it actually provides an opportunity for even paddlers on the outer islands. You know, if you're doing really well in the single events, you kind of get scouted in a way. And like, if you do well enough, Shell Va'a will tap on your shoulder and say, hey, do you want to paddle with us? And they give you a job and things like that, and kind of make it worth your while, you know. So a lot of people kind of say, oh, the Tahitians, they're paid to paddle and all of this kind of stuff. But when you actually go in and you see it, they actually do work. Like, so the main schedule for training, even when I was training with Paddling Connection, is like, wake up at 4 a.m. before work starts, go to the gym, do your gym training, and then you're done by 7 and everyone's off to work. And then 5 p.m. in the afternoon, when everyone's done, you get on the 6-man together. And that's kind of like 6 out of 7 days a week. And all the big teams are doing that, Shell Va'a and all of that. So it's like no big secret. And then if you want to be like the champ of the champ, obviously you train in the morning, 4 a.m., go to work until lunch. And then that 1 hour break that you have at lunch, they go and do a singles paddle, come back, do a couple more hours at work, and then team training in the afternoon. So that's kind of the big, the way that it works in Tahiti. But like I said, the opportunities that may not be big to us, like, you know, just a general job with Shell or EDT, but it's quite big for those paddlers over there in Tahiti. So the likes of Kevin worked for Shell Va'a for a long time. And then the likes of Stevie Boy, Steve Tehotata, he's an electrician, and that's why he paddles with EDT.
Yeah, okay. So there's obviously a lot more to those teams and sort of meets the eye. They're not just getting paid to paddle. They're actually going and working for the companies that they're actually involved with. So there's a lot involved with it. But with the training, what have you noticed? Is it like is it similar or the same to something that you train for in New Zealand? Like, would you train the same way in New Zealand as you train in Tahiti, or is it more about like kilometers and miles, or is it about quality? Like, how are those guys training compared to, say, how you would train in New Zealand? Because obviously if you're training for sprinting, you're probably not training exactly the same way for distance paddling. How is their training programs based around the events they do, like the Hawaii Kanui and Molokai and Te Ato and Super Ato and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, it was an eye-opener for me, the way that they train, especially coming from New Zealand. I feel like what they've adopted is similar to kind of how runners would have trained, you know, back in the day, with kind of similar to like the Arthur Lydiard style training, where there's a bit of volume involved, you know, and then like kind of balance between your longer, slower pedals, and then chucking a bit of interval work in the mix. So with Paddling Connection, during the week pedals would be pretty similar, around the hour to an hour and a half mark, where we would like spend most of the first half warming up, and then we'd take advantage of the good surf that they have in Tahiti. We'd do a surf run down, and then usually the good thing about Tahiti is that you kind of can go out the pass, you'll know this, and surf down, and then you come back up in the flat. So as we come back up in the flat to come back to our training ground, that's where we would do our intervals. So you're kind of getting the best of most worlds. And then it's a big belief, you know, like any sport or marathon kind of sport, is that on the Saturday you go and do a big one, big long pedal. So most big teams, especially if they're preparing for Hawaii Kanui or Molokai, they'll go and do a 2-3 hour, maybe longer sometimes. I've heard stories being longer paddles, you know, into the wind and then surf back and things like that. So I was lucky enough to meet Lewis Loughlin, who is one of the big time all-time greats. They call him the king of Va'a because he won the TI Tour 10 times or 11 times, and he won the Super I Tour 10 times. And then you'll probably know him from Surfski. He went over and dabbled in Surfski in his later life. But we met him the first year I went to Tahiti, and we used one of his canoes. So he followed our New Zealand team around during that race, and he taught us a lot. He told us what he was doing. And he actually said that he kind of shaped the way that Tahiti trained now. They said, because he said he was, you know, on the verge of crazy, what he used to do, the mileage that he would do in a week. He would be out there before the sun came up, getting 2 hours in, come back, and then everyone's out just heading out for their pedal. And then he would come back in the afternoon, you know. So in a way, he set a pretty high standard that kind of everyone kind of follows now.
Yeah, I know Lewis Loughlin from Surfski and his Molokai events, and obviously through Dean Gardner and Oscar Cholopski and those Surfski paddlers, like hearing stories of Lewis. But I've only ever met him once at the Maramu Surfski race. But yeah, he seemed like a really just polite, nice guy. You'd never know he's done so much in the paddling world unless somebody else told you, because he's not going to tell you. So he's a very humble and noble champion. But when you're paddling in these different events, so you got Hawaii Kanui, but then you also do Molokai. What was your experiences like at Molokai? And you're paddling OC1, I think, in the first time. What was that like?
Oh man, that was, so the first time I competed in the Molokai OC1 singles, the solo, was 2015. And I have to say, still early on in those earlier years, like, I wasn't very long distance adapted. So I was always, you know, competing in the sprint, and I'd gone down to Tahiti a couple of times, but I was still in the Te Aito, I was still placing maybe 100 and then 60 between that range. And so the Molokai solo was definitely one of the longest races I had ever competed in. And I was definitely well underprepared. 52 kilometers, I believe it is. And I didn't pack enough nutrition, didn't think about what I was eating, drinking, and I raced it like I would a typical 28 kilometer race, which is what we do in Tahiti and Te Aitu. And I just hit the biggest wall of my life. Like, and I cramped so hard in my elbow. I didn't think I was going to finish the race, but I basically crawled to the finish line. And so it was something that I never wanted to experience again. So I kind of went back to the drawing board, and it was kind of a good learning curve, because later on that same year was the first time I made the top 10 in the Super Idol. So I kind of like went back to the drawing board, kind of put a little bit more distance and got a better mix between distance and interval training, you know, just to prepare well. But I think you got to go through those things sometimes just to learn.
Yeah, Molokai can be a really tough teacher. By doing my first one, I had pretty much exactly the same experience. I went over in 2013, I think it was, did the surf ski and just trained like I would train for like a 25 kilometer race. And I didn't even think about training for longer. And I got to about 2 hours and I fell to pieces, cramping, falling out, like delirious, like all this sort of stuff. And yeah, I learned very early, like, I'm going to do that race, I've got to prepare properly. And I probably haven't done it properly ever because I just never really had time. And I'm always racing those shorter distance of races, like you were doing the sprints and all these different types of races. So it's hard to get right, I'm going to paddle all those long distances now as well. But I guess you were forced hand when you started paddling for Paddling Connection and doing those longer events. But did you have a better experience at any point? Like, did you gradually go back and do more Molokais?
I definitely, from then I competed, 2016 onwards, I competed in the Molokai Hoi 6-man event every year. The first few years I did it with a club called Hui Nalu. And then I believe I even did one event with Mooloolaba, Australia. An Australian team had me come over. And then obviously Kalahui Kai, my new team now, we competed in the Molokai Hoi. And actually last year was one of the best seasons I had, because I spent majority of the time in Hawaii preparing for that race. And so I went over with enough time to prepare for the solo, which is in May. And then kind of after that, I would stay on and prepare for the Molokai Hoi in October. However, last year, unfortunately, one day out of the year, the conditions just blew up, crazy headwind from Oahu back to Molokai, and it was just impossible for us to race. So they cancelled it the morning of the solo.
Oh, they did too. Yeah, I saw this.
That would have been my second solo. And then, obviously, I was training again for the Molokai solo, which would have happened last week, but unfortunate circumstances now. So still yet to do my second Molokai solo. Last year we competed, we trained really hard with Kalahui Kai. Man, it was some pretty awesome training. Just like, I'd probably never trained that hard in my life. And we competed against Shell Va'a in the Molokai Hoi, and they definitely were on another level, but we were second place to them in front of Opiti and Red Bull right up until the last two, three kilometers, where we got taken out in Diamond Head by a couple of freak waves. And so we ended up fourth, which was quite unfortunate, but hopefully the airports open up by October and give it another go.
Yeah, so you were coming around China Walls, and you sort of came too close to the walls there and you flipped. Is that what happened? Or your freak waves came through? Like, you just went cut the inside too quickly?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting, because that was, like I said earlier, we were under Outrigger Canoe Club for most of the year. And so Diamond Head is our training ground. We know that like the back of our hand, especially in the OC1s, we race around there. And those who know that spot know that, like, there's two ways. Either you can just take the risk and go as close as you can to the inside waves and just get these super long runners that will put you in such a awesome lead. Or you can be less risky and take the outside. And during the Molokai, we didn't really push it that close, I thought. We were coming around and we just had this awesome, awesome run. And then all of a sudden, we just looked to our left and this massive wave just had stacked up. And we thought, nah, it's not going to break on us. And then right in the last minute, our steerer turned us towards it. And we did what we could to go through it. But I think maybe seat one and two might have just come through. And then the waves just took us over. And so we would have been all right. So we got back in, or we flipped our canoe over. But then the second wave, as we were flipped over, the second wave landed right on top of us and just completely pulled us up with water. So we had buckets and everything as we were just watching Red Bull and OPT pass us. So, but we were pretty happy. We were happy with our performance that we were even going to get second. That was probably the best position I've ever been in for the Molokai. So it was good.
And who won that race?
Shelva'a won that race. They've been pretty unstoppable for the past 2 years. They've won the Hawaii Kinui. EDT were winning the Hawaii Kinui for quite consistently for 4 to 5 years. And then Shelva'a just came out and just, they've just got this strong team that's just quite unbeatable at the moment.
So who are the names that paddle for Shell?
At the moment, it's the likes of, David Te Pava is their steerer / coach. He's been with them for years. They've won the Molokai. Him alone would have won the Molokai 10 times, I'd say. But the names aren't as common as you'd think. Kevin hasn't been with them for maybe 3 years now. They had this year where they kind of just had this revamp and they brought in a lot of young guys. And I think sometimes you need that. And they just put their heads down. I want to say they started training in January and just went all the way to November, Hawaii Kinui. And so they were just this tight unit. And they brought this new stroke around that was it was they went back to this major slow huti pa'ari thing that they would do, and it just blew everyone's minds. Like Tahiti are known for this fast stroke rate. Blah, 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 blah. They could do that, but they could also, when they wanted a rest, they could do this thing where it was in at the front and then right to the back, and super slow return. It just nobody could understand it.
And what is the different types of strokes in Wakaama or OC? Is it vary techniques depending on your size and stroke, or is it a very similar stroke for everybody?
It's fairly similar. When I talk about it in Tahiti, is that even the big teams, they have slight differences, Shelva'a versus Paddling Connection. They're all quite different, but in a way, they're all the same. And like I said, there was that earlier team back in the day, Team Mogul. A lot of those paddlers who were in that team have branched off and now coach these bigger teams. So it's just different versions of the same stroke. The fundamentals are there. But Paddling Connection, we were really big on a slower, stronger stroke. Just because had a lot more bigger guys in our team. And so we kind of, especially in our longer races, the rate around 65 strokes per minute was a good stroke rate for us when you're not really thinking about picking it up to catch waves. Whereas there were some teams like OPT at the time, and even Shelva at the time, who would really rate it up constantly, and maybe even not kind of holding the stroke as long, tapping up front. So there is kind of different beliefs there, but Shelva'a just really last year or the last 2 years just brought this kuti pa'ari, they call it. And they just really practice this really slow thing. And it was really quite interesting. But then, so there's the Tahitian technique, but then, you know, there's the likes of New Zealand and then Australia, Hawaii, who can have quite a distinct stroke. And I've always believed that it has stemmed from the use of OC1s, which have the rudder, because the rudder kind of has a little bit more drag. So as you like pull a stroke, you don't let the canoe glide as long because it's got the rudder and it drags, it slows you down. So you develop this kind of like a more of a powerful and grunty stroke. Whereas in the V1, you can kind of let it glide towards the end. And I believe that translates a lot better to six man. And that, I believe that's the reason why Tahitian stroke is so good compared to a lot of Hawaiian and Australian strokes, which kind of hold on to that OC1 stroke.
Yeah, it's very interesting talking about strokes because there's just so many different ones, and depending, it doesn't matter which sport you're in, there's like a stroke that I guess everybody sort of bases it around, and then there's like the variations of the different strokes that sort of run through the sport. And it's always quite interesting talking technique. But when we're talking about paddling in Hawaii versus paddling in Tahiti, what was the difference in paddling in those two different teams that you think maybe have made you better or have helped you become better as a paddler? Like, what's the differences between paddling in Tahiti to paddling in Hawaii and training there?
Oh, man. I think last year, the reason why it was such an awesome season was, like, a big thing for me is just being, like, having a solid base, like, being based somewhere really, really well. So it's like, you know, training is just easy. And that's what it was for me in Hawaii last year. Our coach, Alan Pfluger, brought majority of us in, like myself, and put us up and really, we kind of stayed together as a team, a few of us that didn't live in Hawaii, and just made it really easy for us to train. So we were training 6 days a week, up at 4:30 a.m. on the water by 5 a.m. every morning. And I think when you get them to that routine and consistency, then just magic happens, you know. And when I compare it to New Zealand or even Tahiti, New Zealand, like, for example, even my team or most teams, we aren't all located in the same place. So it's hard to get in the canoe consistently and build that connection. Tahiti is a tough one too because I live in New Zealand. So I was only really traveling to Tahiti to train with Paddling Connection for maybe a month before the big races. So it was actually quite hard for me to even get picked in the end because we wouldn't just have six paddlers. We would have maybe sometimes 10, 12 paddlers, and our coach would decide the team the night before the race, you know. So I think the big difference in Hawaii last year, what made it so successful was just being together and training together. I think that's the secret. And that's the secret for Shell. I mean, like I said, they've just been this tight unit for the last 2 years that now they're just reaping the rewards.
Yeah, it's obviously a really important thing to have that group connection and feel like you can hurt for each other and be able to push the finish line. I only have that really team connection from maybe paddling double skis or paddling K4s and K2s in the kayaking when I did that. But you really notice that when you've been paddling together for a longer period of time, you just know if something happens, you do this. If something feels this way, you feel this. I'm not sure how responsive the OC6s are. Like, I have paddled, I did the Hamilton Island race, I think once, and maybe one other OC6 race, but it was very, very difficult because you just had a bunch of ski paddlers thrown in an outrigger, and it was really, really hard. Yeah. But it was good fun either way, and that was probably back in 2014 or something like that. But there's so much value in sort of being there connected with your squad and going into races together and racing hard. So you have the Hawaii canoe you don't change, but in Molokai you change. So how many people are in your squad?
So for the men's division, you get to have 9 paddlers in your crew, 6 in the canoe at a time, and then 3 changing whenever you like. So most teams stick to around about 20 or 15 to 20 minute changes, sometimes getting down to 10 minute changes just to keep the boat fresh. And it's kind of a hard thing to think about, like, changing all the time. You think that kind of would slow you down in a way, but I think, like, the energy you can, like, it's, you got to kind of think about it in intervals. Like, you get in, do your stint at, like, a higher intensity, and then you get out, recover, eat, and then get in, you know. So it does end up being faster than just going iron. But yeah, it's, and then the women, I believe they have 10 people, so they can change 4 at a time if they wish. Yeah, whereas the Hawaiki Nui, when you choose the 6 for the day, that's it. You race, but you can change between days if you want. But one of the difficult things about the Hawaiki Nui, and I was told this early on, is that it's actually one of the best things to do is actually keep your 6, you know, or at least because one of the problems is, you know, if you keep 3 and then a fresh 3 come in, you actually find that the fresh 3 will come in and actually, they have this idea that they have to work harder because, you know, especially if you've had the team on day 1 has had a good result, they feel like they have to make up for it. So they get in and they work really hard. And especially on day 2 is quite a difficult, hot, flat leg. A lot of them end up actually overworking and passing out or having to jump out of the canoe and let the canoe finish with 5. So sometimes it's better to leave your 6 who have the same level of fatigue, because then they work the same and they work together. It's quite a hard thing to fathom. But Paddling Connection, when the year that they won, they only made 1 change, 1 person, and that was only on day 2. And yeah, it's
interesting, the whole, I guess, psychology and physiology of those team races, because if you can change that 3, you think that'd be better, but then you're talking about how people might overwork and not really, and feel different to the guys in front of them. The guys in front of them are probably just like getting into the grind and just like really just doing what they have to do, whereas these guys feeling fresh, so they try to push them harder. And yeah, and it's, I'd never heard of anybody jumping out of a canoe coming into the finish line. So that's crazy again, because I guess they become a dead weight, because I look back at that like race I did in Hamilton Island years ago, and we had 1 or 2 guys die in the boat. No, actually I did the I think it was Hawaiian Airlines event in an OC6 with Outrigger Australia. Gosh. And one of the guys died in the boat, then 2 of the guys died in the boat. It was just like, and I wasn't very good. Like, I was hopeless. I'd never really done much outrigger paddling, but it was just a funny experience to have people just really fall to pieces, and you just feel the whole boat just like drop in the water.
Yeah, for sure.
So you have obviously different experiences in different team boats, but can you talk us a little bit about Tiato and Super Eito, and can you explain the 2 different events? Because I'm a bit confused, but I know Super Eito is the main one, but what is Tiato?
Yeah, so the Tiato is a race that was created in Tahiti, and basically it's the biggest rudderless or singles canoe race that they have for the entire year. And that is like the open. So that one has, anybody can register and do the Tiato. So I remember the first year I went, 2013, there was roughly like 600 to 700 paddlers in one division. And it got to the point where there was too many, so they decided to put the open men separate and the master men separate. So now it's around about 400 paddlers in the open men division, and then 300 in the master men division, which is run separately. And basically, the opens is a 28-kilometer open ocean race, or it's a 2 laps of a 14-kilometer course. And basically how the Super Eito works is, if you place in the top 100 of the Tiato, you get invited back to compete in the Super Eito, which is almost exactly 1 month later. Now, the Tiato course is always the same every year. It's on the same course in Mahina, from Mahina Beach to Taone and back 2 times. However, the Super Eito, is the best of the best paddlers, that one, that course changes, and that is released like only just after the Tiaito. So you can't really like train specifically for it. You never know what it's going to be. Sometimes it's one long leg. Sometimes it's like three different legs. So yeah, it's definitely, it's like the Hawaiki Nui for singles. I think the first year I went, I was like 127th. And then every year I just kind of chopped off. I think I went from 127th to 64 to 37 to 15th. And I finally made the top 10. I think I placed exactly 10th in 2015. And then 2017 was my best result to date, which was 6th in the Super Aito. But the conditions were just kind of my conditions. They were flat and they were inside the lagoon because it was too rough to go out into the big surf. And haven't quite cracked that top five yet, but it's definitely on the cards one day.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredible race. I've actually watched it a few times on the phone, and it just seems like it's such a massive event, and I'd love to see and watch it one day and just see what it's all about, because it just seems like one of those pure ocean paddling events that just have a lot of history and a lot of respect, I guess, if you do well in that race. So I guess getting top six is really, really cool, and I guess you've done really well to get there. But what is that with a rudder, the Super Aito, or is that rudderless as well?
All of the majority of the racing in Tahiti is rudderless. Yeah, so no rudder like in Hawaii. And the main reason for that is, yeah, I think that's where Va'a has stemmed. And you know, all of the canoe makers in Tahiti really only make Va'a. They don't really make anything else. I'd be lucky to count 5 OC1s in my entire time being down in Tahiti, you know, that like that's how dominant the rudderless paddling is. And then you go to the likes of Hawaii, which is basically all OC1 rudded paddling going on, but there's a high increase in rudderless canoes going on in Hawaii at the moment, and they've got their own TI tour in Hawaii, like a small event to qualify for like a free trip to go to Tahiti. Same as in New Zealand, we have the New Zealand iTour. You win a ticket to Tahiti. So Tahiti and Hawaii are just on these separate, you know, canoe type spectrums. Whereas New Zealand, Australia, we're kind of a little bit in between both. We have pretty much 50-50, I'd say.
What is the difference in design between, except for the rudder, obviously, but what is the difference in design between an OC1 and a VAR?
A V1 is definitely, I'd say, definitely a bit longer. There's a bit more, I guess, waterline there. And it's a little bit more complex, I think, on the bottom of the hull. There's a combination of round and V in the hull in order to keep it running straight. And so it's definitely, the V1 is definitely, despite the rudder, I think it's still a faster flat water canoe, you know, even though the OC1 does have drag. However, I think the OC1s that are created now are super, super light. You know, they're getting made out of China, outrigger zone, and they're super light. So they're more and more, they're getting like competitive on the flat water too. OC1s, they're a lot shorter and a bit more volume, I'd say, and then designed for big wave surfing. And yeah, it's kind of like when you go, like last year, because one of the main reasons I went to Hawaii last year was to kind of experience that whole rudder scene, because previous to that, I'd always gone down to Tahiti. That was my big thing. Go down, feed in the rudderless. But yeah, I just kind of wanted to go and just do a real solid rudder season. So I kind of came into Hawaii as like the underdog last year and competing in these OC1 races. And I remember going to my first training with the likes of Travis Grant, because he was in our team too at the time, Tuarunga Colin, and all these top OC1 paddlers from Hawaii. And I just remember getting tuned up, getting left behind. I just didn't have the understanding of the craft, like the little feelings that, the little differences that is required to surf them. And so for the first couple of weeks, I was just getting owned. But when I finally like kind of clicked on and just found the little secrets, you know, to paddling an OC1, I started to come back and managed to win a few, couple of the races over there. I think I got the Oahu State Championships and a couple of relay races with my friend Tuarongo Colin. And then, yeah, we were definitely prepared for the Molokai Solo, but unfortunately it was cancelled. So, yeah, next time.
Well, it was always interesting for me to learn that the first OC1 was actually created from a surf ski recently just by doing these podcasts. I had no idea, but yeah, that was a fun little thing to learn. Obviously now, like hearing about the different designs between the V1 and the OC1, and then obviously the different techniques as well, because I know, I guess, to put in an example for, I guess, some of the listeners, like going from an unlimited sup or going from a surf ski to a stand up, like an under a 14 with no rudder, it was like really hard downwind. And I guess it would be kind of similar to a V1 and an OC1, because the OC1 you'd have a steering system, which is, for me, is natural because I've always used a steering system. And then removing that and having to walk the board and having to kind of steer with the paddle and do all that different stuff, which you probably have to do on the V1, would just be quite a hard technique. And being able to jump between the two would obviously be quite challenging as well. So there's so much that goes on and is involved with paddling the two different crafts, because if you go to Hawaii, you paddle one. If you go to Tahiti, you go to the other one. And they're sort of on two different trajectories. But it's obviously fun to be able to jump between the two and then gain success and actually learn those crafts, which makes that a little bit more fun. I know you did a little bit of stand-up paddling. I think you raced the New Zealand Nationals, maybe in 2015, 2016. Can you tell us a little bit about your stand-up paddling career or challenge?
Yeah, that was an interesting time, 2015. Yeah, I think I was at the same time. It was kind of when I was really getting into the long distance scene, and I got in really good shape that year. And a guy from New Zealand, Dale Masters, he lent me one of my first stand-up boards. I kind of wanted to dabble in a bit of cross training with stand-up paddling. And I think I had a SIC board. And I kind of found out that there was a race coming up. I think it was Nationals. I think it was Nationals. And there might have been another race before that, that I had competed in. I just loved it. And I probably trained for maybe 1 or 2 months solid. I was just like, even on flat water, I was just down on the Waikato River, just getting in a bit of training. I felt it was kind of hard for me at first. Like, I would probably equate like 30 minutes, or let's say I would equate 1 hour on the stand-up to like 2 hours on the outrigger. Like, that was how sore it was for me in the beginning, you know, to get used to it. But I really surprised myself. I think it might have been, the Nationals might have been in Omaha. And I remember getting, I think I was fifth overall. But because the Hasulio brothers weren't New Zealand citizens at the time, I managed to get third place overall. Yeah. So I was third place in New Zealand champ. And this was, I think, was still around the time that stand-up was still on the rise, especially in New Zealand. And I didn't really carry on that much after that, but I came back the following year and competed in one race. And oh my God, the level of paddling was just like so high. I couldn't even compete. I was like, oh my God, everyone's just so good, you know? But yeah, it was a good time. And I wouldn't mind getting back into it, but, yeah, that's always a question I wanted to ask people. Am I too heavy at 95 kilos to compete? You know.
Yeah, I think it helps to be a little bit lighter and a little bit smaller, I think, for stand-up paddling, because you do have that lower center of gravity and you just, I'm not sure. There isn't too many bigger guys. I'm not really a bigger guy, so I can't tell you, but it's definitely very different. So with these different like sports going forward, which one do you think you're going to mainly focus on? Do you think you're going to do more OC1 or more VAR, or which is the ones that you're really trying to do well at? Because there's so many different various events really, and they're so also very different.
Yeah, good question. I think this year, my plan this year was really much more OC1 focused after competing in Hawaii last year. So the main goal was solo again this year, was going to go do solo. And then we were planning to go to the Gorge Dalman Champs OC1. And because I picked up last year, I picked up a sponsor by Kai Wa'a, who's probably the best OC1 on the market at the moment in Hawaii, the Aries Canoe, it's called. Kevin Saranjadushalemi also paddles for that team.
So we're on Travis paddles as well, the Pui?
Oh, he's on the Kamanu Composites,
okay.
Pu'el team. But there's a few on the team, and we're going to go down to Portland, Oregon, and give that Gorge race a go. That would have been really fun.
Yeah.
So I think from, you know, probably not going to have a proper season until next year by the looks, but I'll probably be a lot more balanced from now on. A bit 50-50 on the races as opposed to predominantly rudderless, which has been in the past. Because I think, personally, I believe they complement each other. Like, it's definitely helped that I've started on a rudderless. You know, it's a lot harder for me to go for, a lot harder for people go come from a rudder, like you said, and then go jump on this rudder and rudderless and not know and just get frustrated trying to steer the thing. But you know, I've got a respect for both of them at the moment, and it was a big respect when I went to Hawaii. And like I said, I was getting my ass kicked by all these Hawaiians. It just gave me this much more respect for them. I was like, nah, it's not just a rudder. It's like, yeah, you've got a rudder, but now you've got to worry about like directions on the wave, these like all these little things, you know. You just like, it's just another racing level. So it's definitely something I'll hold on to.
Yeah, it's always something different between the two different crafts or whatever craft you jump between. Like, I have a lot of respect for different crafts because I've done a few different ones, and you think, oh, I'm going really good in this one, I'm going to turn up and like, smash this other division. And then you go and you get smashed and it's just like, ah, oh, crap. Yeah. Yeah. And so will you do the sprint? I know you focus on the sprinting as well, and you've got a lot of titles there in New Zealand. And you said there was like, sometimes there's like 3,500 people turning up to these events and competing in the sprints. So sprinting is obviously a big thing in New Zealand for the Waka Ama. Can you explain a little bit of those titles and what they mean to you versus what these other events that we've been speaking about mean to you?
Yeah, I think the sprints will always be a big part of racing for me. But like I said, it's only really 1 month out of the year, that January New Zealand National Sprint Championships. And then the Worlds happen on alternate years, every 2 years. So those are only the two events that are really sprint focused for me. So majority of my racing is long distance, but I'll always have a big respect for the sprints. It's one of the most exciting times of the year. And but the only thing now, like I said, so from 2015, I was 5-time consecutive champion. And that was at the same time that I was just kind of discovering Tahiti and just really training hard myself. So I kind of, like the look at it, I like kind of came in at the right time to be able to get that those five consecutive titles. Because now it's a lot harder. There's like so much good competition, and we have the 250, the 500. Because majority of my races are long distance, I'm quite suited to the 500 now, more so than the 250. And it's kind of coming to, when you look at kayaking, Olympic kayaking, like the difference between a 200 meter sprinter and a 500 meter sprinter is just, it's crazy. Like, so I can barely make the podium for the 250 now, because there's these like really strong, like one of my friends, Ash Rosendahl, who actually beat the New Zealand Tahitian paddler this year, and the 250 is just this super strong, powerful CrossFitter who really translates his power onto the water now, you know. And so it's kind of showing that, like, if you really want to specialize in an event, then you've got to, like, really focus on certain things. And that's kind of like what's opening my eyes up now, is that it's becoming a much more competitive environment. So if I really want to do come back and really do well in the sprints, I have to kind of really, like, push myself away from how I train for the long distance and really, like, you know, get in a bit of strength and power training for those shorter races.
Yeah, it is quite hard to do both, because I know that I've never really been a sprinter. And when I train for sprints, I have to really train for sprints, but it does take away from my distance racing, where I am better at. So that when we go to those APP events, when you have these 200 meter races where you're, like, doing turns and all that sort of stuff, I'm, like, not very good at. But then I go to distance race and I think I won the every one last year. So it's just like, it's like, I want to be good at both, but I don't want to be average at both. I want to be, like, at least good at one thing. So that's not a decision you have to make. And you want to, obviously, if you want to do good at those longer distance races, you kind of have to focus down on them and hope that you can hang on for those 500s. And, but I guess you've done such a good job. You've won bronze medals, I think, at Worlds, like, three times, something like that. And you have, like, those different opportunities. I know you've raced in Rarotonga as well. And what's the big OC race over there?
So the big race in Rarotonga is the Waka Ewa. That was a big race back in the day when I was still, I think the first time I went to that race was 2007. So I was just a young kid and I just went over with an older team and had some fun. And then 2010, went again in 2010, and then 2013. So it was a really popular event, the Waka Ewa. It was a really cool week of racing. But it's kind of mellowed out a little bit in the last couple of years. It's not as popular as it used to be. I'm not too sure why. Maybe not as much promotion and sponsorship around the event. But it's definitely a cool place to go to. And they get pretty Tahitian-like waters, if not bigger. Like, they don't quite have the same lagoon structure as Tahiti. It's almost like you get out there and it's just only big waves, you know. So you got to paddle into the big waves and surf back with them. So it was always a fun time.
I circumnavigated, or I paddled all the way around Rarotonga on a surf ski one time. It was really, really fun. We came in through a few of the passes, but there isn't much of a lagoon structure. And you guys punch out through some pretty hectic passes sometimes as well. So it makes it really, really fun. What sort of inspires you now to keep paddling hard and keep, like, racing? Like, what is really pushing you to keep staying inside in the sport and chasing those titles or chasing those results that you want to achieve?
For me, like I said, like, I haven't won any world titles, like, yet. And the likes of the TI Tour, Super I Tour, or the Molokai Solo, they're always these massive events that I just hold, you know, right up here. So, like, in my mind, like, I'm 26 years old. I've been going hard for 7 years, but, you know, there's going to come a time where, you know, due to age and physical ability, I'm going to start to decline. So I kind of want to make the most of the time that I do have. I love competing. I'm pretty sure I'll always love competing, but, you know, I'm always motivated by those bigger races, especially the international prestigious races. And, I just really enjoy it. And I think things, like, definitely with the Train Like a King has come about, there's definitely a different aspect that I'm focusing on too, starting to look to the younger generation and, like, potentially look for different opportunities, like, where I can help out young teams. Like, I kind of, you know, I am doing a lot of coaching clinics and stuff now, but it would be really cool to one day maybe train a team, you know, train a team to go to the likes of the Hawaii Kinui and the World Championships and give back like then. But like I said, I'm not really ready to become the coach, because I guess once you become the full coach, then you kind of sacrifice your own performance. I kind of want to be the athlete as well, a bit of both, you know, that balance. So, but yeah, it's just the growth of the sport, and the hope that one day it's gone with younger paddlers that, especially from New Zealand, are gonna get the same opportunities that I've had, which has been amazing. Like, I think I've only had one trip in my life that hasn't been paddling associated, and like, so paddling has taken me so many places, and yeah, I'd love to do that for the next generation too.
It's really nice to be able to travel and paddle and meet so many cool people and with like-minded sort of approaches to life and wanting to get out there and get the best out of themselves. But hopefully the next generations, no matter what sport that we're in, they have the same opportunities or better than we have at the moment. So it is cool to hear you have a similar approach, I guess, to someone like me who wants to see the sport sort of flourish and sort of see water sports in general flourish. I think it's really, really cool. But what does, so for a Waka Ama paddler, do you have a job as well, or is the coaching stuff your job now? And how do most of the guys make money who aren't in those big teams?
Yeah, no. So since I've left university, I haven't really had a full-time job. I've just been picking up jobs here and there. Before lockdown, I was based in Auckland. I was working casually for a company. We've pretty much been rolling Train Like a King for a year now, and basically still in the process of growing the business, where everything from training programs to coaching clinics. So I did have a really good balance in Auckland between my casual job in a factory and then coaching clinics, averaging maybe 4 coaching clinics a week in Auckland. Training programs online and things like that. So, I mean, the ultimate goal, we really want to grow Train Like a King as much as possible. We want to give back to our, what we call our Pepe Shark community, like our baby shark community. We've got running this free online platform for kids under 16 that receive every like free tricks and tips from me. And yeah, we just want to continue growing that merchandise and whatever. So we're waiting for this lockdown to kind of disperse before we get back to it.
Yeah,
it's been a little bit of a good break at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been an interesting period for everybody. How have you dealt with the COVID situation? Like, Molokai's been cancelled, years sort of in tatters, like most of the water sports athletes in general in the world at the moment. How have you been dealing with it, and what have you been doing to sort of keep busy? Have you been training more? I know I've seen you in the gym, you're doing a fair few videos and different stuff. Like, what have you been doing to sort of get yourself through this period?
Yeah, so before the lockdown, I was based in Auckland, and obviously because I had the job there, I had the option of, it was an essential service too. So I had the option whether, you know, I could carry on being in Auckland and working there, or come up north to my family home with my partner. And that seemed more appealing. So we came up to the far north in New Zealand. That's where we are now, on a nice piece of farmland. So we've just been hanging out here for the past 7 weeks pretty much in lockdown. We're in level 2 or level 3 now. So we went through a stage where I wasn't able to get on the water, so a lot of our training was just land based and stuff like that. But the past 2 weeks we've been allowed back on the water, which has been awesome, because the past 7 years I've taken no more than, the longest break I've taken is probably 1 week or 8 days, if that. So this was the first time I've had like a actual proper break off the water. And, but yeah, pretty keen to get, I'm back on the water, but, it is a bit hard, like you said, not having like a clear, distinct race to train for. That's the hardest part about this whole thing, I think, is just, you know, how do you train, and, you know, 'cause you don't know what event what's next.
Yeah, it's so interesting, the whole period, because I've kind of looked at it glass half full, or I tried to at least, and sort of looked at different things that I haven't been doing that I can do. And then you sort of have this rest period that I probably haven't had in the past, I don't know, since I was a kid. Like every year I just train and race and go towards goals. And it's kind of been like a quite a nice sort of break to see, like just give yourself a bit of a recovery, like to stop yourself chasing the next thing, you know, like it's just been nice to sit at home and not do so much. But obviously it's a bit hard when you're so used to, like you're probably in some of the best like physical condition of your life and you can't get out there, you can't race and you can't compete and see where you're at with against those top competitors. So it is hard both mentally and physically, but I guess everybody is going through it, which makes it nice. I guess if it's not nice, but it makes it better for you as an athlete, because you're like, well, everybody else isn't allowed to go out there and race as well. So that's the only thing that I'm holding dear at the moment. It's like, at least I'm not injured and then everybody else is out there racing. At least it's like my body's getting a rest and maybe it'll help prevent injuries going down the track.
Yeah, exactly. Slow down those Tahitians.
Yeah, absolutely. So, mate, thanks so much for coming on today. Is there anything you wanted to add before we jump off air, like shout-outs to sponsors, shout-outs to your training plans and where people can find out more about you?
Yeah, you can find us or find me on Instagram or Facebook. If you are interested in any training programs, coaching clinics, then you can email us at training@tupuriaking.com. You can also check out the website, trainlikeaking.com. There's blogs and all sorts of stuff up there. Thanks for having me on. Michael, was definitely a cool opportunity. There's definitely moments when we were starting up Train Like a King where I would take over and have a look at what you were doing and with all your website and stuff like that. So you were definitely an inspiration for us and kind of set a standard there. So pretty awesome to see how well you went from and quickly went from surf ski to just dominating the stand-up realm. That's pretty cool. So cheers for that,
mate. Really appreciate those kind words. It's obviously cool to see that you're looking at my stuff, because I guess you do want to be a sort of a bit of an inspiration for other people, and you want to help bring up water sports in general. Like as you were talking about helping the kids out before, it's like it's all about trying to bring everybody up, and we want to see the sport get out to more people and have more people appreciate the water as much as we do. So it's been awesome. But thanks so much to everybody who has been watching the Boothcast, and to if you want to watch more, go to Boothcast in my video section on Facebook. Listen to any of these, go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Mate, really appreciate your time again today. It was great talking to you. Great, obviously, learning a lot more about the Waka Ama scene and hearing about the different events, because it's something that I've seen but not really listened or heard about. Oh, one thing I did want to know is, what is the difference in speed between a V1 and an OC1?
Ooh, I think that's a good question. In general flat water, I think like a V1 will probably, a good speed is around about 12 kilometers an hour, like a good average speed. OC1 would probably sit at about 11 and a half or something, like just a little bit slower in the flat. But then your ability to stay on waves on OC1 and just go wherever you want is what will inevitably like get you a far, even if it's a small wave, like just a extended boat wake from the far that's on a major angle. The OC1 will just sit on the angle and just ride it, you know. So it's a kind of like a win-win or trade-off.
Well, very good. I'm glad I got that question in, because I was very interested, because I did a 10k time trial in the flat the other day, like just with no train, just to jump on one. I think I did like 52 or something like that, so I'm not sure what average speed that is, but I was like, I wonder what the top guys do.
That's pretty good.
I don't know. I don't think I'd be very competitive in the downwind or anything like that, but it was good to have a fun play. I think I went paddling with Gordon Simpson. I think you might coach a few of those guys over here in WA.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We went paddling on one of his Outrigger Zone canoes. But anyway, mate,
I did see that.
Really appreciate your time again today, and I'll talk to you very soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Ray.